This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
When it's time to go after the biggest buck of your life, you need gear that will not only make your life easier, but that you can also depend on for years to come. Lone Wolf Custom Gear has been the leader in mobile hunting equipment for over 40 years and started out right here in Wisconsin. From inventing the climbing stick to perfecting ultralight tree stands, Lone Wolf Custom Gear continues to innovate and put the best mobile hunting equipment on the market with a ton of fantastic accessories that allow you to customize your gear exactly how you want it. Whether it be the high-end DeQuisto series sticks and stands or the affordable Patriot series, you'll have the peace of mind knowing that you're hanging off of gear that was 100% made in the USA, right here in the Midwest, in fact, and has been designed and perfected by some of the best whitetail hunters in the world. Not to mention, it has an unconditional lifetime warranty that's so good your grandkids and even great-grandkids will be able to use it when they're hunting. Go build your kit out today at lonewolfcustomgear.com.
E-scouting is the crucial first step to any great adventure, but sometimes we gotta swap the muck boots for flip-flops and the shotguns for fishing rods and get out on the water to recharge those batteries. Whether you're in search of the lunker that broke you off last summer or trying to get the family out for a day on the water, you need to have a game plan. That's where Onyx Fish comes into play. With detailed bathymetry maps, expert information, historical fisheries data, and filters that allow you to hone in on your next favorite lake for a multitude of species, this is an angler's best friend. Shoot, I'm actually planning a father-son trip to the North Woods with some buddies right now, and I already feel like I've got a game plan in place to catch more fish than the rest of those guys. And the best part is, it's easy, intuitive, and based on the same platform as our beloved Onyx Hunt app. Go check it out today and start finding your next honey hole at onyxmaps.com/fish.
Fall is here and it's time to get out in the woods. And when you do, you need gear that's going to keep you warm, dry, and concealed while you're pursuing wild game. That's why I'm proud to be partners with Huntworth Gear, the makers of badass, affordable hunting gear that's readily available and won't break the bank. You've heard me talk about this gear for years now, and for good reason. Their Heat Boost gear is the warmest hunting gear I've ever worn, and guys, I promise you, I'm not just saying that. It beats the heck out of traditional merino, fleece, or down hunting clothes. Not to mention, we've got a ton of great new camo patterns, including our new waterfowl pattern, Oberus, which has been expertly designed to keep you concealed from wary ducks flying overhead. To go get kitted out for this fall, visit huntworthgear.com or head on over to the sporting goods section of your local Farm and Fleet or Fleet Farm to check it out in person. Southwest Wisconsin is home to one of the most unique trout fisheries in the country, with thousands of miles of spring-fed streams twisting their way through valleys, pastures, and prairies. And one of the best ways to experience this fishery is with a fly rod in hand. Good Chance Fly Fishing is your guide to all that the Driftless has to offer, whether you're an experienced angler or you're just looking to try something new and get into fly fishing. To find more info and book your trip, visit goodchanceflyfishing.com. If you've listened to this show before, I'm sure you've noticed that if there's one thing that keeps coming up over and over again, it's the importance of public lands and waters. Shoot, I'd venture to guess that 90% of what we talk about on this show takes place on public lands. We all love the challenges we face and the memories we create in these wild places, and we need folks who are in our corner to protect them as well. That's why we're proud to have partnered with the good folks over at the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Wisconsin BHA Chapter was formed to provide a voice for hunters and anglers throughout Wisconsin that want to protect our public land legacy, and everyone involved worked their tails off to protect public lands and access to those public lands and waters. To stay informed on all things public lands, the issues facing our public lands, policies that might affect them, and to cross paths with some of the coolest outdoorsmen out there, I highly encourage you to join the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, or at least the chapter of whatever state you live in. Also, be on the lookout for our Wisconsin Public Land Policy bonus episodes to keep you all in the loop on the legal side of conservation and how things get done here in Wisconsin. To join BHA, visit backcountryhunters.org/join, and to learn more about what's going on here in the Badger State, visit backcountryhunters.org/Wisconsin.
There won't be a physical tag. The old man in me is very nervous about this. I'm told the millennial side of me is still gonna, like, it's gonna be okay. You can just use your phone. The tag is gonna be on there. But like all the old timers that I encompass and I work with and hunt with, like, I haven't heard from them yet, but I can already tell you that they are worried because they're gonna be like, well, what about this? Like, I don't know if I have any data. Or it's like, you're gonna be fine. But it's just something brand new. And it's something, when there's something brand new in Michigan, it immediately gets red flags. Everybody gets nervous about it. I'm sure it'll be fine, but yeah, tags in the digital world is dicey.
Definitely. Well, especially that I think about that older generation too, because I mean, Michigan and Wisconsin are such like core rooted hunting tradition type states, right? Like old timers who have been around hunting, doing this thing since the 80s or even earlier than that, they grew up with those tags and like the old back tag system and stuff like that. But now that they're starting to age out, you've got a lot of older hunters that are still in it and they still want to do it. But it's like that you're almost to a degree starting to put a little bit more of a technological barrier between that older generation and them being able to hunt and actually enjoy their hunt and make sure they get everything. Cause I mean, shoot, even when I hunted Iowa last fall, that was all, I did like a digital harvest report, and that was the first time I'd done it through text. Cause there's like a little number on the tag and everything. And I mean, one, the verbiage in the text was like, made me feel like I needed to like take another law class in high school to make sure that I was doing everything properly. But also like, I don't know, man, just that many texts and like trying to go through and like, okay, what number are they looking for? They're asking for this. Like, yes, it was beyond this. Like, and all, I don't know, just all the different things there that went into reporting the harvest, especially through the phone. I think if I had a computer, I might've felt a little more secure in my abilities there, but
yeah.
Because Wisconsin, we've had e-tags for, I want to say at least 10 years, it seems. It's been quite a while, but we've had e-tags and like the online registration and the buying tags. I think they've got that fairly streamlined. But yeah, when they introduce it to a new state, especially one where you've done it paper in hand for years and years and years, I think, yeah, this is definitely going to, the DNR will have to earn its trust, I think, from the hunters would be my guess. Because like you said,
yeah, people don't. Ooh, they're not doing a very good job of that right now, though. They're already in hot water and they're now wanting to do some more. Yep. But yeah, like I go to the gas. There's a little party store in town. That's where I get my tags every year. This is old man Nick talking. That's where I get them every year. And it has nothing to do with the tag itself. I can go 100 different places, but I go to this little party store.
It's tradition.
And now that it's going to be online, you're like, yeah, I can do it for my app. To keep that, do I got to go do it in the park? Like just we were talking a little bit ago, stealing McDonald's Wi-Fi or stealing Panera Bread's Wi-Fi. Like, do I got to go and just like park in the parking lot to like say that I still got it from the party store? This new idea or like not having the physical tag. Cause I got buddies who will take that tag. They get it from Buck. Yeah. It goes on, but that goes on the back of the plaque. Mm-hmm. And then gets hung up, that there's something more than just a tag that they're doing away with. Now, every answer, logically, going with the e-tag, going full digital, it's purely the way that it needs to go. I will get over this the next season, trust me. But when I'm told, well, just say, hey, we need you to report your deer and we want you to do it on your phone. I guarantee there was a lot of people who didn't because they were scared of putting their own information out on the internet. Mm-hmm. You know, they got to get through their tinfoil hat. They are a little crazy out there. But at the same time, there's people that were just, I've never had to do that. So why am I going to do it now? And I think that's the battle that they're going with now, that change. And I don't know. I put hunting and fishing right up there with baseball. We are so sentimental. We're so superstitious. You name it, we're going to do the same things over and over again. And it's just ingrained into that tradition of what we do. New stuff scares people. Yeah. It's so funny how that works out.
Yeah, definitely, man. And it makes you wonder too, you know, that generation who wants to hold on to doing things the way that they were doing it before. I was talking with Dan about poaching last week a little bit, and like, poachers are going to poach regardless of if somebody's inclined to do that. That's one thing. But makes you wonder if you, theoretically on paper, the idea is with e-tags is that there's no excuse not to have your tag. It couldn't be easier to have your tag. But for some people, that's not the case. And for some people who, like you said, might have a tinfoil hat on, they don't want to put their information out there and all that stuff, like, are they going to be purchasing a tag this coming year and still going hunting? I don't know. Like, it makes you wonder. It's kind of, you know, there's demographics. Like, we've got a big CWD problem in Wisconsin, as I know Michigan does as well in some spots. Mm-hmm. Like, you get the people who
it's knocking on my
believe
door
in it, and you get the people who do not believe in it. And the people who do not believe into it, or maybe they believe in it, but they don't care about it. I don't think it's as serious as it may be or whatever it is. You know, if we were to put in some sort of a mandatory CWD testing when you submit your thing, because like I personally, like on the note of in-person events, I miss the deer check-ins. I miss going and dropping off a deer and checking it in and like going to the map and having to point to the DNR and like where it was and dropping up or sticking a little pin there, and they'll do all that stuff. And you see everybody else's deer and their bucks and all the tradition of that there. If people have to start bringing CWDs or bringing deer in for testing, I think we're going to see fewer and fewer deer than we already are.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
Because right now it is I want to say it's a problem. They used to have a head drop off for the CWD.
We've still got plenty of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Michigan had those, or at least my county had that for 2 years. And I participated in that fully. Loved it.
Yep.
And then it went to, well, now you need to pay to send it in. And it was like, it became an extra step. It all of a sudden became cumbersome. Yeah. And that made it hard for me to, you know, like, man, the other one was easy. I just drop it off and then it was good to go. But now I got to submit it in. I have to either get the nodes out. I know there was chit chat out of the University of Minnesota that they were going to have basically a field test kit
that
I don't know if it was necessarily litmus paper yet, but where you could then basically know in the field whether it was positive or negative. And that got me really excited. So far, I have not heard any more other than that was an idea. That's all I've gotten. But I'm not a politician. I'm not even a very good administrator. So like trying to say like, how do we roll out a system that makes everybody happy with something that they don't necessarily believe exists? And at the same time, we also want you to buy tags that are just digital form. I tell you what, it's a large undertaking that the department is taking on. So, I mean, good luck to them. I'm going to participate in some way, shape, or fashion. But yeah, it just seems like a lot coming at me.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I don't even want to know what the behind the scenes work and coordination of some of these DNR offices looks like right now. I mean, yeah, it's just like you said, it's a massive undertaking to add that kind of a change or implement that kind of change into a pre-existing system that is designed to continue tradition, but also has to remain modern, right? It's a tough,
absolutely
tight rope to walk there, but I am very excited about that potential for like a self test or a field testing kit for CWD. I think that would, if anything, is going to make CWD research and I think CWD mitigation even close to possible more mm-hmm. than it is, like truly like bring it into the modern era and allow us to gather real data. I think people are going to, because like you said, it's a cumbersome process, or it certainly can be when you've got the thing I think we talked about it the last time you were on the show, you've got a 2-week turnaround period between the time that you drop off your head and the time that your deer gets back to you. Like, what do I do with my deer in that time period? I'm sitting here, I got some stuff, you know, might develop that rind on the outside. Some of it, you know, might spoil some of it, you know, you can, but you also don't want to go to the trouble of maybe butchering and packaging and grinding or whatever an entire deer, and then you find out it's positive. You're like, well, crap, there's, you know, an entire weekend of work.
I have this wonderful meat box of meat, and there it goes. We're pitching it out.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, it's tough. But, well, folks, welcome to the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast. We hit record a little early there, and I really, really liked it. This is your home for all things hunting, fishing, and conservation in the Badger State. Presented by Lone Wolf Custom Gear. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis. And as you can tell, that was the first time doing an intro like that, Nick. So thanks for gritting your teeth through that. But folks, what got us on Absolutely. The topic there, I've got Nick Otto, host of the Huntivore Podcast with me. But what got us on that topic there was the debacle that ensued this morning as I and many others across the state logged in at 10 a.m. to the DNR Go Wild login site to get that leftover turkey tag, only to find that they could not purchase one within the first hour or two. And many of you had the site crash. I had the site crash multiple times. I was in line multiple times. If you're a real one, you ran to the local hardware store or wherever, and you bought one in person and made sure that you got it. But I ended up securing a fourth season tag. So I've got third and fourth season right now. I'm super excited for that. My dad ended up getting a fourth season tag as well. This will be his first year turkey hunting. So I'm very excited to get him out in the woods and hopefully get him on a bird, or at least have a couple come in screaming in our face. And whatever happens from there happens. But hopefully we have a first turkey story to share later this spring. But Nick,
That'll be fun.
Yeah, man, I can't wait. But dude, I'm even more excited in the moment to be chatting with you about some spring cuisine, which is on a lot of folks' mind. Now, if you were like me last year, you ate way more turkey than you had planned to because you kind of dropped the ball on the venison front the year prior. So I cooked a lot of turkey in 2025. I cooked quite a few good meals. I cooked a handful of meals that were a little questionable, that were a little, not questionable as in like its edibility, but like certainly didn't prepare this in the proper way. It was a little tough. It was a little dry, which I know some folks tend to run into when cooking wild game, turkey in particular, it seems. But Nick, before we dive into that and all of our springtime cuisine, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? We kind of alluded to it at the beginning here. You're a Michigan fellow from across the pond. And man, tell us a little bit about who you are, where you're from, and a little bit about the Hunter Board podcast as well.
Sweet. Pierce, again, thank you for having me on. Yeah, I think I was on. Yeah, it was definitely last year. We got a chance to chat. Yeah, Michigan native. So next door here to Wisconsin. Actually did a trip. We left our wonderful state of Michigan this summer. Went through Mordor, I mean Chicago, and then got our way up into to Wisconsin. We did the full length. We went from Appleton. We camped in Appleton. Went up near Oshkosh was our next camping destination. Worked our way from Oshkosh all the way up back into the UP. Went through Menominee there. I forget what it's called on your side, but got through Menominee into the Upper Peninsula, which, I mean, that is a heaven and a place called Earth. And then we worked our way back down through the Mitten State. So I've had my fair chance to be over there in Wisconsin. Yep, another podcast on the Sportsman's Empire. A bunch of like-minded gentlemen and ladies who really have a passion for being outside and pursuing their drive, depending on, and it's fun. We've got everybody covered. It feels like there's the out west crew, there's the out east, there's the south guys, state specific. You getting after Wisconsin and what all it gives out in bounty. That's just so cool. I do the same in Michigan. I'm really trying to, you know, be a big part of my state and try to venture out in different areas. Did some ice fishing up in the UP this year. So that's kind of been early jaunt that I've been able to have after deer season. But honestly, after the shot is where I find myself at home. That's why I listen to all the other podcasts, to help me become a better hunter, to help me become a better angler, to help me become a better forager. And the better I get, the more opportunity I get then to celebrate that hunt, to celebrate that outing on the lake through the wonderful use of our wild proteins. Whether it be white off of turkey, whether it be deep red off of a big buck, whatever it is, I want to be able to celebrate it. And I want to take you guys along the same journey that I am. How can we best utilize our hard-earned harvest? So that's Hunt a Boar in a nutshell. And yeah, trying to spread my wings even a little bit more. We'll get into talking a little bit more about this, but I've got my three boys that are in that ripe age of, I want to get them some experiences. I want to get cut their teeth on some experiences and let them choose what type of sportsman they want to be. Is it going to be in the water? Is it going to be in the woods? I want them to decide that. They may pick it up. They may not. That's the beauty of it. And I just want to make sure I portray it the best I can to them and letting them have some successes. But at the same time along the way, like, yeah, you didn't get something because we have to earn it. That's what makes it the best that it can be. That's why we do this day in and day out. When we're not focused on work, we're daydreaming about being outside. So that's kind of what my up-to-date doing is right now.
Absolutely, man. And how fun is that to have three boys that are at that age that they're starting to really get into it, man? That's got to be an absolute blast of just kind of getting to, like, where, like, I guess that's a question for you, I guess. Where do you begin? Like, what do you think is going to be the first step into the outdoors for them, do you think?
We're currently angling. We have got the fish scene down. Ice fishing has been our go-to. Last year I picked up a 12-foot aluminum Miro boat straight out of Wisconsin.
Nice.
It's got a 4-horse, 2-stroke it's an Evinrude. It's an Evinrude 2-stroke motor, four horse. You hear us before you see us. That's how the, we're not going anywhere fast, but we're out there. Mm-hmm. And we've lost a pole already. We've figured out how to use a fish finder. They like Berkeley gulp bait because it's easy to slide on and we get more use out of it than we do a mealworm. Yeah. Those are the things we've kind of figured out now. Panfish are good. We haven't done a whole lot with bass. My youngest has a buddy who all he does is bass. So there's a lot of bass talk, not a lot of bass catch. But we definitely like the fish fries. We definitely go after hard crappie and bluegill. And that's where we do focus on with the ice fishing as well. Panfish, perch, that's our focus there. We do chase small game unsuccessfully as of right now. Dad has scored the most on that, but at least we're getting a chance to work with some firearms. And then deer, I would actually put a couple of my boys on a knife before I would put some of my buddies that are my age. They can cut. I tell you, they can cut and they can clean. We go out into the blind on some hunts, so they do join in with me. I give them the thumbs up or the thumbs down. So I've had one of each. One boy gave me the thumbs up, and we dropped a doe, and he got to experience that whole, now we got to find her, now we got to gut her, now we got to get her home, that whole adventure. And then the other one, I think he was a little spooked by the dark, because dark was coming. He would rather be heading towards the house at that point when we had deer come out. And he gave me the thumbs down. He's like, nah, we're not doing this. So I've had both give them to me, and I like that I'm letting them do the choose your own adventure, because I think with like living with their decisions, but then I think at the same time, I think I'm learning too. It's not always about the end result. Given being in the place of, I mean, paradise that I'm at, this is my 40 acres behind me, joined up to the family's farm. There's always going to be opportunity to go out there. It's whether or not, you know, success is merely just the next time that we go, as far as putting something down. Now, if we were to pick an age class and really dive in deep into scouting things out and finding out where the big bucks are at, then, you know, that's going to take something a little bit of effort. But if it's just to, if it's brown, put it down. We've got the opportunity more times than not. So having that flexibility, having them choose their own adventure really has been a good chance for them to get their feet wet. I'm going for a gradual release. I guess that's where I'm going with the boys is we're going to get there. The sixth grader, if I can find a deal on another saddle, I might hook the sixth grader up and get him going up in a tree with me so that it would be dad and son up in the tree. Very similar to the blind, but at the same time, like really give him that next level of, oh, now we're climbing a tree at this point. Totally. Instill that safety bit in him, really working with your lineman's belt. You don't do anything with that until the tether is on. And when if you're going to take the tether off, well, then you put the lineman's back on. And if it's windy and you don't feel right, then you have both of them on and you leave it alone. But to really instill that thought process of safety first before we start having fun. But at the same time, I want them to enjoy that, starting with dad and then gradually release as we go along.
Yeah, definitely. Well, there's so many small lessons that they can pick up with each of those little introductory steps too. Like, I mean, just on the saddle hunting note there, like they're going to start thinking, okay, like dad likes this tree. Is this tree going to suck to get up and down? I don't know. Like maybe it kind of will, or it's okay. If dad's going to hang on that side, then that means I'm going to hang on this side, which means I'm probably going to have gravity trying to swing me down into this, spot or whatever. So where might I be? And just like, you know, thinking through the gymnastics of mobile hunting and that from a strategic standpoint. And It's even cool too. Like, I like what you said there about trusting the boys with a knife, and, you know, doing some of the butchering there. Cause you're not the first, father that I've had on the show say that in the last couple of months here. A buddy of mine, Matt Geiger, he was talking with his daughter, cause he does a lot of antlerless hunting, particularly on ag tags, which are basically like given to you or given to landowners by the state. So you can effectively harvest does out of season as a means of crop damage mitigation. He takes advantage of that program quite a bit. And he was saying that he was out there in the shed with his daughter and they were chatting about stuff. They were talking about deer and he was just kind of sitting there and they were chatting. And then all of a sudden he looked down and there was both the back straps, both the loins, both hindquarters were quartered out and the shoulders were laying there and she was working on one of them. She was like, "What the heck? How did that happen?" Like, we were just sitting here talking and she just, from watching him do it that many times, just picked it up and knew like, oh, well, this is what we need to do here. And here's how we trim that. And these are the lines or the seams that we follow here and there. And it was just the coolest thing, man. So, I mean, to be able to share that, because I think a lot of times that is, I love what you said there about the Huntivore podcast too. And like the, after the shot being the portion of the hunt that really speaks to you and like the most fulfilling part, because it really is, man. I mean, that's where like the labor of love comes in. The hunt is the fun part, but the harvest and the, you know, eating on that deer for, you know, the year to come and or the turkey or the fish or whatever, and then being able to reflect back, like that's where like the fulfillment comes in, right? So yeah,
absolutely.
That's super, super cool.
Hey guys, I just wanted to take a quick sec to tell you about Lone Wolf Custom Gear. Lone Wolf Custom Gear is as good as it gets when it comes to mobile hunting equipment. Whether you're a saddle or stand guy, public land or private, Lone Wolf Custom Gear has a set of sticks, a stand, a camera arm, and any number of accessories to get you closer to your target buck. To make it even better, everything is 100% USA sourced and made right here in the Midwest. And it's even assembled right across the river in Iowa by hunters who love chasing deer just as much as you do. To build your kit today, go visit lonewolfcustomgear.com. Now, let's get back to the episode, man.
I'm going to let you in on it. This is going to be crazy. And this is what I like about the podcast world is I'm going to tell you something that happened in the past here about an hour ago, but this is going to launch before that episode comes out. So the future is going to happen before the past. So buckle up, everybody. I just had a conversation with an author, Christy Green, and we unpacked that exact idea, labor of love. In her book that she talks about, she talks extensively about her connection with these animals, with the elk that she's pursuing, and the decisions that she made and how it reflects onto her. And I shared too that it's, yeah, I've picked the, you know, I feel most at home after the shot. I would say I'm better with a boning knife than I am a rifle, but at the same time, like I'm still working really hard at the riflemanship or at the marksmanship, but honing that skill with a blade, like that's where I really tell my story. This is my pen that I'm telling how I'm a hunter, and it's because I'm going after this meat. So white-tailed deer here in the back, they're just an amazing animal. And when I get to harvest one, I'm the first one to lay my hand on this wild critter that I've done the deed to put it down. And when either you grab the rack or even just picking up the doe and feeling the weight of that, like things become very real and things become heavy at a moment, both metaphorically and weight wise. And so to then wrap your head around, this is what I've done. I'm going to own this. I am going to grab this animal and physically drag it. Because there's no more truer sense of being a hunter in the fact that I've now shot this animal and it's done the best it can to seemingly get away. They never run uphill. They never run to the truck. They always find the deepest, darkest hell hole, and that's where they expire. And now you have to then, I mean, you as a human, yes, we are part of creation, but you are literally ripping creation from creation at this point. And you feel that tear, and it's not easy, and it's hard work. It builds those relationships that when you do have somebody grab another leg, like what a bond you get. Like we're ripping creation here out. this is the, you know, first essential metaphorical flesh of this coming out, and we're doing this together. Mm-hmm. And that moment of being able to get it back and that exhaustion, this isn't supposed to be easy. And I feel sometimes that with our privilege, this was the term that I heard, the privilege of money or the privilege of equipment and the privilege of these different stuff, we can minimize that effort. And having the side-by-side to pull up and have the winch just drop it in and to quickly get it back before the body's that even had a chance to set up, we've fast-forwarded through a lot of the experience that you could get from that. Mm-hmm. Now, there is convenience. There is, hey, I need animal A to be at garage B right now. See you later. Let's get this done. I do understand that. There's a time and there's an essence, and if there's a something that you're desiring to do afterwards, then like that's what you have to do. But we also, these are steps that can't go away. If we're totally reliant upon the processor to do that, I'm disconnecting myself from that hunt. It becomes two hands touching that. Mm-hmm. It becomes less of a personal asset. And then maybe I'm speaking on my own terms, but when I get a piece of meat out and I cook it and I make it and I enjoy that eating, like I relish the whole aspect of it. The flavor profile doesn't just start and finish with making the shot and watching them drop. It's the whole afterwards bit about that that gives it those notes that you really hold up on. So long story short, I loved that. And that was a soapbox that I had to stand on, because it is after the shot, I feel is being lost in the realm of convenience. And I want us to still appreciate that. Because there's moments like you were talking about your buddy with his daughter. There's got to be shed time that happens. And there's got to be those long conversations because you're there having to do a long process thing. And I mean, why is maple syrup so sweet? Because it's a 40-to-1 and you got to be there and you got to boil that stuff forever. Wild game is very much the same way, that you appreciate those pieces, those morsels, more so when there's blood, sweat, and tears that have gone into it.
Absolutely, man. I'm so glad that you got on that soapbox there. That was fantastic, dude. And I couldn't agree more. And I especially agree with you on the note of like what you said there about feeling, I don't remember exactly the words you used, feeling more at home or feeling more comfortable, whatever, with the knife in your hand during that process than you might be with, you know, your marksmanship. And again, like I'm right there with you. Like I am far from the best shot with either a rifle or a bow, but I feel pretty dang good with a knife in my hands. And like, yeah. There's something about just like that slight, you know, vibration and feeling like the knife kind of work its way through like each fiber bundle of muscle and stuff. Like as you're, you know, trimming up a back strap or feeling that kind of like sizzle underneath it as you cut through connective tissue and all that. Like there's something visceral and primal and just human about doing that. Cause that's, I think, what, you know, our ancestors didn't have the $1,200 carbon fiber, 348 FPS bow or whatever it is. They were doing it, but they were still having the same exact process of butchering and cleaning that meat and harvesting and everything. And yeah, it's, unfortunately, it doesn't sell as well as a new bow or a new gun, right, or scopes or whatever it may be. But that 100% is, I think, where, I don't know, circling back, just the fulfillment of all comes from, man. So, yeah, it's...
I would also like to know a stat. I don't know how we would ever figure it out. It would be the biggest undertaking ever. Maybe it needs to go into the new digital survey that happens at the end of the questions. But which is used more, grandpa's gun or grandpa's knife? Which is taken into the woods more? Because in my small group alone, we're heavy on the knife. I got three grandfather knives that are going out in my group of seven. And I think there's only two that use grandpa's gun. So yeah, it's a 3-2 split right now. But that would be something interesting to know. Like, again, as we were just talking about this, like, tradition and, like, passing things on, like, I'm thinking, like, which is the more desirable piece? Is it grandpa's gun or is it grandpa's knife?
Totally. I think grandpa's gun is going to start making a strong case. I think with the combination of just the price of all these new guns and everything that's coming out in the market, but also we're in this kind of almost renaissance era of hunting, it seems, where a bunch of guys are going back in and we're starting to pay a bunch of attention to the trad bows. And like, that's getting a lot of love and guys are kind of going for that really old school, really stripped down, you know, pure woodsman, no trail camera, just going out there with a stick bow and seeing if you can get it done. I kind of expect in the next handful of years here, I think we're going to see a lot more of grandpa's gun coming out into the woods there, because guys are going to get that kind of itch, like, you know, grandpa's had that old 30-30 that I don't know if that thing's even been shot since, you know, the last time he went hunting or whenever it was, or I don't know. I think we're going to see a lot of those older guns come back, and I think it's going to be a pretty cool time in the deer woods.
Yeah,
yes.
I do have the farm gun. It's great granddad's gun. It did kill a deer. It did shoot a squirrel. This is all the history that I've got for it. I wouldn't put more than field shot in it.
Yep.
I feel if I put a slug in there, I would be taking a trip to the hospital. I do not know the condition of all this. It does rack. It does do what it's supposed to do. Maybe not in the most smoothest of it, but it'll throw birdshot. So it's like, that's as far as I'm going to get. I'll probably shoot clays with it. You know what? Maybe it needs to go on a small game hunt. It might need to go on a small game hunt.
There you go.
Very soon, just so that I can join in the tradition aspect of things. But yeah, I definitely would not put buckshot or a slug in it, because I think I would pay the consequences on that.
Yeah, no, I hear you there, man. That's such a great callback to the farm gun, because that's something that you want to talk about a dying breed. The farm gun is a dying piece of equipment there, because I mean, I ended up getting my grandpa's old Winchester 1906 pump action 22 after he passed away. And that thing had more duct tape and custom crap on it because it had just gotten knocked off the wet. It literally had been, I mean, the buttstock had a big crack through it that was full of wood glue and a piece of duct tape wrapped around it, where it had fallen out of the tractor and then been run over by the hay wagon as he was pulling it. But he would keep that thing with him while he would shoot rabbits or, you know, squirrels or raccoons or whatever he saw while he was out farming. And
the amount of woodchuck that has probably seen its demise to that 22. That's what I think the farm, I think it specializes in woodchuck. They are always trying to get under everything. Generations have been taken out by this weapon.
Yep, dude, that's such a great point, man. I forget about the woodchuck, because there is a season. There is often in most states, there's a woodchuck season. And I think it's pretty liberal if my memory serves me well. Yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot of restriction on there. So
I hide under the nuisance laws here in Michigan. The season opens when I see one. So that's how that usually goes here. The dog does a good job on them too. If I don't have a firearm with me, the dog does a good job. I have yet to really, I've felt emboldened to give woodchuck a try. Like really get down and do like shredded woodchuck. I've got a couple people that have done it. So that's what's given me the green light to do it. Like, all right, we're going to do this. And then it's just, usually I'll shoot one and it'll be like, there's no way for me to get to any sort of refrigeration. There's no way to get me any closer to being at home. So it's like, unfortunately, this thing's going to ride around the back of the gator for a little while. Like, I don't feel safe about, you know, after I've popped it through the gut, you know, it's going to be done and real smelly here real quick.
Yeah.
So it's merely just that I haven't got a good opportunity at a good time to be able to take one and cook one up. But it's for on sure. the it's on the docket there.
Dude, keep me posted. Yeah, I was going to say, when you do, please do. I can't imagine it would be horrible. Can't imagine it'd be great. I wouldn't seek it out, I don't think. But I'm right there with you. Curiosity would definitely get the better of me if I were given like a good clean headshot or something where I was like, all the meat's going to be fine and it's in the backyard. Great. Let's see how this goes.
I mean, this thing is living on, A, living on crops that we're growing. B, it's living on like little clover here and there along all the grass areas. Like,
I'll be your vegetable garden.
High. Yeah. This thing is full of absolute nutrients. The fat alone on these things, they are incredibly fat. Like everything points to delicious on these things. It's merely, I think it's just the form of everybody's like, I think they see large mouse and I don't think they see large squirrel. Like, I just think like this is a squirrel. Who's just, I mean, it's just a very obese squirrel on steroids. Like, I think there's just, there's a bounty to be had here, but it's all on opportunity. July, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, when the thing's out there sunning itself, not the time to shoot one and be a couple miles away from the, from an ability to clean them out. So
no, definitely not.
No, that's the only problem.
Yeah. My mom tells me horror stories of when my grandfather was younger and she was a kid growing up on the farm. They were in Eastern Iowa and they were big into coon hunting. And every fall, I think in like November or so, they would have a big coon boil or a coon roast where they would basically put them on a spit and roast them over the fire. And she said the amount of fat that just would come pouring off of these dang coons was appalling to the point where she couldn't bring herself to do it. But I've always wondered, I don't know.
Oh my goodness. I put them, squirrels, or excuse me, not squirrels, raccoons. I feel like raccoons have enough fat. Like, we don't need whale oil anymore. We can if we just figure out how to do raccoon tallow or raccoon grease, we could run the world with that lubricant because there's just so much of it. They are fat critters.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. And that was exactly where my brain was going as well. With both the groundhog and the raccoon there, the amount of tallow based, you know, whether it's soap or candles, whatever you're trying to make, I bet you could do something pretty dang good with a bunch of raccoon grease. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, low and slow and barbecue sauce, anything can be covered up that way.
True that. Well, on that note, man, diving into our springtime cuisine here. Let's start with the fish, man. It's still Lent for another week or two by the time this comes out here. Fish fries are running rampant across the Midwest on Friday nights, man. Give me the rundown of your favorite fish and how you like to prepare them.
Gotcha. I wish I had more opportunity on walleye, on getting some of the bigger fish out there. Now, we did do a jaunt up to Cedarville. We were up there. That's in the UP. And got guided by Greg Whipple, good friend of mine. Does an amazing job up there, right out of Cedarville. And he got us onto lake trout. What a fun experience. Nice. These things look like sharks in the water. Mm-hmm. The water was clear enough. We were down there watching. We were basically sight jigging these things. And to watch them just jet in out of who knows where, hit our bait. The way he hit my lure, he came in and does like a 360 and literally tail whips it to knock it out. And then comes back and I happened to just move it out of the way that he jetted under. Instead of going for my bait, he went for my buddy's bait. But how fast they come in, how agile they are. These, like, when I see them from side profile and getting them out of their element, you're like, this is a cumbersome, slow, like, not a very, like, how does this thing eat? It must be really little slow things. But then you watch it hunt and you watch it come in. These things are prime. So I did get a chance to, we got a lake trout out of there, 24 incher. We were told that was a good eater. And of course I was like, yep, fillet that puppy out. I'm going to take that. So I've got plans for him. But that whole trout and salmon route, my family's actually really enjoyed that oily side of fish. And so we frequent that more than we do the white fleshed style fished. Your walleyes and your cod, burbot, I know it falls under there too. I just haven't had my chance to get in on that. But where I've lacked in necessarily the size of it, perch, bluegill, crappie is where we live. You know what? We're happy to stay right there.
Mm-hmm.
Eating panfish is something we highly enjoy. We do have a Christian background. We're not Catholic. We do honor the season of Lent. We don't necessarily follow it to a T, but I do know that there's a huge population of people who does, especially here in the Midwest. I know tons of people right there at the neighborhood Catholic church that, I mean, yeah, fish fries are huge, and they've got the same old that they've always been done. There they do a wet batter on a piece of chunk of whitefish, and then it goes into the fryer and comes out the other end. And to say that, like, that needs to be improved on, no. I think we're setting pretty good with that process. Are there things that we could tweak that could really amplify it? Absolutely. With my small fillets, I think this step could be applied into even walleye. I think it can get any of the bigger white pieces of fish, giving a chance to brine the fish before it goes into the oil, or excuse me, goes into the batter, is going to save on the amount of seasoning that you're going to have to put into the batter itself to get any sort of seasoning out there. And second, it's going to widen our time between it goes from flaky succulent fish to a dried out cracker.
Yeah.
Some of the bluegill that I have had to fillet, with my sons being like, yes, we are keeping this fish. And I'm like, bud, come on. I can't get my blade under that. What are you talking about? I need the Havilon just to, you know, kind of get in there next to the rib that I'm going to slice off. Mm-hmm. We've had to save some really small fillets. What I have found, and I actually stole this trick from Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A brines their chicken in pickle juice or pickle brine.
Yep.
I've applied that to all of my panfish. That, I think, is the play for the flaky white fish, whether it's the big piece, whether it's going to be the small piece, doing a brine previous and just using a pickle brine. Shoot, you're already making the tartar sauce that you're going to need the pickles for. So This just all falls in line. But that little bit of brine is going to help moisten that fish. It's going to give you a little bit of a salty flavor on the inside. It don't taste like pickles. If you're not a big dill pickle fan, you can choose some other brine. In fact, I also used, banana peppers in a jar. I ran out of pickle brine. I used banana pepper brine. That worked just as well. And it just offers that ability to, through our high school biology class, it goes through, diffusion and osmosis happens and the salt gets drawn into the cells of the fish. And that's going to provide that flavor. Now, let them lay out a second because you are going to go to the fryer. We don't want these wet. That's going to be bad news. Lay them out there a little bit. Let them air dry. Then they go into, I'm a dry batter guy. I like dry batter. Cornmeal based is what I'd like to go. Honestly, a catfish mix is what I go with. I've also seen several other dry mixes where it's just cornmeal based. And I'm like, boom, that's what I want. I really like that, the more granules on the other side. I think it really gives a stiffer crunch to it. The wet, I've avoided from the wet just because you really got to watch your temperatures on the wet. You really want to make sure with a bigger piece of fish, I think it works better with the small panfish fillets. I think you end up with like a pancake and a fish like nugget on the inside. Whereas when you have the bigger fish, it can hold up to more of that wet batter. The dry batter, I think, lets the fish do more of the talking. So that's where I've gone with that. But both could service having that brine, making sure that you air dry it just a little bit before, even pat dry it before it goes into the batter. That way you get that tackiness. It's going to stick. And then cast iron is king if you're going shallow fry. Otherwise, volume is king. If you're going to do some deep fat frying, the more oil that you can get hot and keep hot, that's going to help give you the better result. Because that temperature fluctuation, as soon as you drop in a bunch of fish, there goes your temperature. It comes right yep. down. So anywhere between 400 and 350, you're looking at a really nice golden brown piece of fish. You're getting into that 425. Things are going to move fast. Things are going to move quick. I would definitely be on top of that. So yeah, maybe that 375, 400 area is going to give you a nice golden crisp to the outside of that fish. Ladle them out, let them drain, sprinkle of salt, eat them hot. Can't screw that up.
I love it. With those batters, both your dry batter and your wet batter, do you tend to just use a custom homemade blend? Do you just grab off the shelf the Shoreman's Lunch? Like, what's your go-to for those?
You can go, it really depends on what your setup is. There's going to be people that have the tried and true. We just talked about how we are very superstitious. We live on tradition. There are people who are going to buy Shore Lunch every time because that's what Dad did, and that's yep. what Uncle Dave did, and that's what yada, yada, yada. That's what we do. Get the Shore Lunch. I'm not telling you not to pick that. I personally have found, again, shopping around, there's a local guy that makes them around here. It's a Skeeter's brand. And dude, I love that one. I'll buy two, knowing that I'm going to have a fish fry one night, use one, and then I'm just making a stockpile because there's going to be a night those boys are like, so fish, we're doing that tonight. Like, okay, I got to have it at the ready. So having a package at the ready, whether it be a Skeeter's, a Shore Lunch, a whatever. But honestly, you can just quick make one at home. I would go half and half, do like a an all-purpose flour and cornmeal, mix those together. Then you can judge from your ratio that at that point, do you want more of the corn on that? Do you want more of a smoother finish to it? You can choose either way that you want to go with that. A little bit of cornstarch in there as well. I'm thinking between teaspoon and tablespoon into that mix. Throw some salt in there. I wouldn't pepper it by any means, just because pepper does not do well at high temperature. I've actually started adding pepper after I'm done cooking because the pepper oils will scorch really fast. So when you pre-pepper something, say you throw it on the grill, you scorch a lot of that oil, and then you don't taste it. It's just like black flecks. So pepper after, and I've been getting more black pepper flavor. Now, when you get into like low and slow, I gotta figure out what the temperature is that they start to scorch, because if you do it in the crock pot, pepper does an awesome job. Right. Do it on the grill though, and you lose your black pepper flavor. So I would stick with just salt in your seasoning, maybe a little mustard if you really wanted to get fancy, the powdered mustard. Add that in, but I would keep that real simple, and I would let the fish do the talking, because you're going to add the brine in it before. Add it to the meat. Don't add your seasoning into the breading.
Got it.
When it comes to the wet, I would say lean pancake batter. That's got to be your whatever brand you end up doing, whatever mix you want to do. It's consistency. You want to be able to coat that fish, but you don't want to basically have a biscuit with this little fish piece on the inside. It will take some trial and error if you're coming off fresh, but at the same time, there's enough people who does fish fries. You ask two or three people and they will give you, they've got an index card ready. They'll be able to share that with you on how they do that. But yeah, dry, I would say season only with salt. Wet, I would say consistency is king. You want to make sure that it's a lean pancake mix.
I like that. Makes perfect sense. Really good tip there too about the pepper. I never had heard that before, but it makes perfect sense because I've done many a taco recipe that hasn't quite turned out how exactly I thought it was going to. But I started adding in my seasoning afterwards, after I kind of let things, some of those flavors come together a little bit, and then season on top of that. And that tends to work out really well. I had no idea that the pepper was actually just getting burned out in the process. That is fascinating. Does that go for, so I've done, we're going to hop onto the transition to turkey here in just a sec, but yeah. I've done it with fish too, with some, like I've used the Meat Eater, I think it was like their mermaid blend seasoning or some, whatever it was when they first came out with those different seasoning blends. Yeah. I used their fish one on, I think it was some walleye or bluegill maybe. I think it was bluegill. And did that, but I was seasoning the meat first, like the fish first, and then doing the batter. And then I was like, it didn't quite taste right. So I tried mixing it in with the batter to get that flavor in after there. If you're somebody who's going to go the route of like using some sort of a seafood seasoning blend, like a Meat Eater blend or a Spice Out or whatever brand you're after there, would you recommend like work that in at any stage, work it in after the fish is cooked and just kind of sprinkle it on top to give it a little dusting? What's your thought there?
I would say definitely on the way the fish is being prepared is going to help that. Okay, so if sure. We've got high direct heat, for the case of the deep fat fry or even the shallow fry, that's where we're running into our problem is that oil is at a very high temperature. Let's transition that to like a side of salmon. So when I do a big fillet of salmon, or even shoot, we could even say walleye or whatever, we got a big fillet that we're doing, I keep skin on and I will season the flesh. Skin side down, season the flesh. I will put on the pepper, I will put on the salt, I will put on the lemon zest, the garlic, the whatever I'm trying to do, I'll put that on top. Because then I'm going to sear only the skin side. I don't flip. I season just the skin side of it. So when I lay that down in my cast iron pan, that heat is directly hitting the skin and it's not transferring up onto the top, scorching all of that seasoning that I've put on the top. Mm-hmm. As the meat begins to warm itself through, that's when I get that infusion of those ingredients in the top. When I finish it, I go into an oven a little bit slower. I'm thinking like 300 degrees at this point. I'm not bumping up to 375. I try not to. My wife is definitely like, hey, the way I get this done faster is if I go hotter. I don't know if that's exactly how everything always works. But at 300, I don't get that scorching like I would at like a 375 or a 400. Sure. So you're going to get a better bang for your buck with your mermaid seasoning or whatever seafood seasoning that's coming out, if you are not giving it the absolute direct heat right on that. That would be more on like a roasting side or a searing side.
Sure.
If I were to baste I do it in a pan where I'm searing the skin and I'm still got it like, you know, whipping hot, butter in the pan and now I'm basting the top of it, I'm going to then sprinkle on the seasoning at the very end. I got to let this piece of fish rest, sprinkle that on while that's resting. All that warm butter that's still on, that hot butter on there is going to carry that into the fish.
Is it
over that scorch point? No, and I think that's why we're going to get that. But as soon as we get into that deep fat fry, all of those wonderful little pickups that we want from the seasonings, I think are lost just in that process because we're dealing with, you know, 400 to 425 degree oil at a lot of points. We got super hot oil because we want the fish in and we want the fish out. So adding the seasoning after is going to be probably the only way you could do it on the deep fat fry. Or I would go with a larger piece of fish. You could do that in a searing oven style roast.
Dude, I love that. thank you for breaking that down, because you just saved me, and I'm hoping a bunch of our listeners, a bunch of the seasoning budget for this year.
Right. Well, even just heartache too. Like, yep, you come up, you have something that you put all this work into. You have the story about this fish, and now you're serving this fish up, and people eat it, and they're like, "Oh, this is really good fish." But you really wanted that pepper to stand out. You really wanted that seasoning to really just make this sing. I thought this was supposed to be the stuff, and I scorched it.
Yep.
It's okay. We can come back from this. Do it again. Just find that different method on how you want to use it.
I love it, man. That's awesome. Moving on to turkey, the bird that's on everyone's mind right now.
Absolutely.
How do we A, maximize our bird, and B, avoid I loved the text that you sent when we were trying to set up our episode today, because I was like, Nick should, I know he works in education, but he should really be in like marketing or sales or something like that. The text you sent, and throwing out some talking points, which we didn't even talk about the meaning of venison, but bird is the word.
We're going back around because someone needs to get schooled in that one.
Yeah.
A friend of ours. We're calling out Dan Nine Fingers today. Don't you worry. Before
yes,
I hang
we are.
Up, we're talking about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. But you said bird is the word. Dry and tough is in the past. Modern bird hunters keep the legs and the wings. And I was like, yes, you're damn right they do, Nick. So
absolutely.
How do we prepare those cuts in a way that's gonna honor the bird and the hunt that we just had with that bird? How do we maximize it?
First, I'm going to burst everybody's bubble. The painting Norman Rockwell did, I forget the name of it, but it's a very famous painting or picture image. And it's grandma standing there with the roasted turkey and everybody's around the table. I think you see the picture that I've played out here. That turkey has never existed. That perfect turkey has never been done. And I know there's a young lady listening right now somewhere to this who is prepared to do next year's Thanksgiving. And she was told this is how Aunt Judy does it, or this is how, you know, Grandma Jeannie did it. And she's got to live up to this bird. Listen, that bird never existed. You cannot cook. You cannot cook this bird with all its complexity at one time and get it all perfect. There is no way, because of the dramatic effect of this bird. It runs for its life and it flies without any inhibition of hitting anything. This thing is a survivalist, and one method cannot cook this bird. It needs to have purposeful, a purposeful hand when it comes to dissecting this bird apart and using each of these pieces. Now, all that being said, we can use every bit of this bird for something good. I was trying to look it up real fast. I couldn't find it, but I have an episode on Huntivore where I break down every part of the turkey, where I go through, okay, this is a whole bird. This is where I would then make it into a half bird. And that's where I would then cut the crown and I lay it on the half. This is where I would then, if I wanted to, have a whole breast and I cut on the top. I walk through that verbally. I wish I could have shown it visually. But I break all these pieces down. Then you got to think about the purpose, or excuse me, the outcome that muscle was doing. The breast. The breast is white meat. The breast did see work. I mean, you can make a tough piece of breast really fast. But think of it more like a bodybuilder here. There's not a lot of richness in the breast because it has one function, and it's to flap those wings to get it out of danger. And it's not for a marathon. This thing is crashing. It falls better than when it flies. It's a big bird, kamikaze style. All it needs to do is get up there enough to then coast. And that's all those breasts are meant to do, is just quick, hard bursts. Like, we're thinking we're thinking clean and jerks at this point. That's what that thing is doing. And giving that a brine or a marinade, giving that a quick sear, and, you know, then to like squeeze some lemon on it. We all know about schnitzel. You can, you know, you pound it out, you bread it, you hit it with a little lemon after you fry it up. The thing is an amazing piece that you can have. You can smoke it. So you can then turn around and do it low and slow where you're giving it time to relax. And then when you cut it against the grain or cross grain, you cut it with, it's going to be pretty rubbery. But as long as you cut it against the grain, you're going to end up with a very flavorful piece of meat. I see a lot of guys that do breast them out and they leave the skin off because they just take the breast out there. The skin is going to help protect a lot of that moisture. Keeping that on there is that protective blanket. So plucking your bird is going to be something not everybody wanted to hear, but there is merit to plucking your bird and leaving all that skin on, especially as we roll around to those thighs and to those legs. I think I just need to walk around behind every turkey hunter and I'm going to find all the turkey legs that I would ever want. I can find all the turkey thighs that I ever want because mm-hmm. I think that's probably one of the most left out there things. I think waterfowlers are the next ones when it comes to their legs and thighs from Canadian geese and from ducks. Well, no, I'd say the ducks are small enough. They keep those. But I think Canadian geese, I think those are left out of there a lot. And it's really on the method on how you go for these things. You want the true story of a wild turkey. We always go to the breast. Everybody points to the breast, but I think it's in reverse. What does the most work on these birds? And it's going to be in those legs and thighs. This thing is a marathon runner before it is supposed to fly. Yeah. This thing will outrun just about anything that chases after it. I mean, it's one of the only bipeds that's out there. It can sprint. It can change direction. It has the ability to do that. And with that, that story is written into something that is super tight, something that's super sinewy. But all of that translates into flavor and to taste. How do we capture that? It's going to be low and slow. If you start doing those things in the oven at 300 and you're cooking it just the way you would the breast, you're going to throw those things out forever because you're not going to harness the gelatin. You're not going to harness all of that velvety goodness that begins to soften as this thing is applied with low and slow moist heat. Those sinews that you hate, they start to relax. They start to begin to let go of it. And this doesn't happen fast. This happens over time. In your Dutch oven, in your crock pot, we're looking at 8 to 10+ hours. You just went and found the big bad Tom who's been running for his life for the past year and a half. That's where all of that is going to be harnessed, is in those legs and in those thighs. It's dark meat for a reason. That's that mitochondria. That's the work in there. That's the flavor that I want. That's the story of this bird's existence, is relegated into that dark meat. What's nice about the thigh, there's not near as much sinew on that. You can smoke a thigh. And I tell you what, dark meat has always been my favorite. But then when I've had the opportunity to help somebody out with their wild bird, to pluck it, to give them some pointers, and I'm gifted what they don't want, I think that's funny. It's kind of funny. But they're toss me a leg or they toss me a thigh. That's exactly what I go to it. I brine that thing. I smoke it. I'll finish it in the oven. I'll cheat even. I'll put it in the oven where I have a little more control. Let it rest. And then you just slice that thing thin. I can't think of a better springtime sandwich meal. Shoot. I know. Well, instead of lettuce, the ramps that I'm laying right next to as I'm trying to hunt this bird, pop a few of those things, give them a quick saute, sprinkle those on top, then put your Sammy on with your mayo there. That's where that's going to be at. Smoked thigh is right up there, I think, with any tenderloin you could ever have. No but even kidding. Those legs, just shred the meat out there. Shredded meat can be used for anything. It can mm-hmm. be tacos. It can go into a pasta. It can go into shoot and go into another stew. Those are all those aspects of dark meat that can be used that I think are underutilized because it takes a little time and a little effort beyond the hunt. That's where that's going to lie. If you were able to give a little time after and to really play with that a little bit to allow the crock pot to do the work, you will be paid in dividends when it comes to getting the most out of a wild bird.
Totally, man. Dude, that was phenomenal. And I love the emphasis on the legs, man. I should have worn it for today. I've got one of Dave Owens at the Pinhoti Project. He's got a shirt out there. It's got like a taco on the back of it with a big drumstick in it. It says like save the legs, whatever. I should have worn that today. I can't believe I spaced on that. But dude, that is my favorite. I mean, really year round, but springtime in particular, that's my favorite meal is just slow cooker turkey leg tacos. But I love what you said there about how shredded meat can be used for anything, because that's something I always overlook. I'm like, okay, I've got a breast right here. I need to cook the whole breast and I need to, you know, slice it into fajitas, or I need to use it for, do like a turkey Caesar salad or something, you know, whatever it may be, or schnitzel, like you said.
Yeah.
Slow cooking, shredding that out, that you're absolutely right, man. That can go in with anything. And that's, you just got me out of a big dinner time rut, my friend. That's
yes. Here's one that I really, really liked. And I think there's a twist here too, talking about, so we started this talking a little bit about morels. The spring, and you were saying like, what's the big springtime thing is, well, it was actually off of a domestic bird. Sorry, off of one from my family. My family, come on. but I had shredded up a drumstick. Did it in the crock. I like the Dutch oven because I get to work with it a little bit more. I think there's a drier heat to it, the whole thing to it. Anyway, I had the time, so here I was. I did it in that, and I shredded that all out. We had some bow tie pasta. We had some peas that were from my buddy's garden that I was able to incorporate those. I did pull some ramps out. So I had those in there. The perfect ad would be morels. But the shredded turkey with it was just in butter. But I just wilted all of the ramps that were in there, put that in there, and then the peas on top of it. If there was just a little bit of like fungi to go into that bow tie turkey pasta with ramps and a morel, holy smokes. Shoot, little truffle oil on the top of that. You mix that up in together, crack a little back black pepper because they're not adding the heat anymore. That just screams every bit of springtime. And you could do that any day of the week. That would not take a huge order, even on a Tuesday where you got to ship kids off to practice or you've got extra meetings afterwards. That's something you could do very quickly, but how it would just harness every bit of spring that we're looking at. I mean, those spring snap of the peas in there, utilizing those ramps that we get for just a short period of time, shoot, even shorter period of time, the morels to dump those in there and elevate a velvety, succulent meat from the leg of that bird. Boom. There you go. There's springtime in a dish for you.
Dude. 100%. You mentioned earlier on the legs, leaving the skin on. So pluck them out, leave the skin on. When you're removing the legs, you just kind of find that same seam or that joint that you normally would if you had already skinned around it or anything. You just kind of cut it off at the joint, leave the skin around there, pluck it clean, obviously, and cook it skin on. Will you do that basically to retain moisture? Is it does it add to the dish? Like, talk to me a little bit more about what leaving the skin on does for the legs.
Gotcha. When I was saving the skin on, the two mains that really benefit from it is going to be your breast and the thigh. They are going to, with the skin on, and I would even say the wings, mainly if we can talk wings another time too. But holding that meat together on the wing, the skin is going to be beneficial for that. When we get to the leg, the skin probably isn't going to be as big a play culinarily. It will probably provide a little bit of flavor because you've got the fat that's underneath it. Second, it will provide a little bit of the moisture because even though it's almost see-through, you're going to have some of that fat rendering from underneath. If you blast it in the leg and the skin is torn, it's not like a pheasant sort of thing where this skin is so uber thin that it's just going to shred right off. It's still going to be stuck on there. But to just put that in the crock pot and not even worry about it, the added value of that moisture that's going to have the chance to get in there, that little bit of insulation holding it, it's going to help it cook a little bit more even. Is it going to be necessary for this to happen? No. If you have taken the bird off and it's torn the skin and you're like, well, now I've ruined this whole thing, this is not a culinary fail. If you lose all the skin on your bird, I would say still keep every bit of this. This is the added little extra bit. If you're looking to up your turkey game, skin up. If your turkey game is, I'm not ready to keep skin on, we can still save all of this. Keeping that skin on is going to offer you benefits. If that skin's off, you can still have beautiful shredded meat because it's going into a braise, be it the Dutch oven, be it the crock pot, shoot, be it the sous vide that you just put it on the wand. Put it for 35 hours. Put it for 3 days. Just watch the water level, because what I have found, if you don't have a lid, your water will go down and then eventually the unit shuts off and you're at work and you have no idea that it shut off and you come home and you're like, why isn't this thing cooking?
Oh, no.
We rebuttal. We got back from that. We picked up again. But at the same time, like, let the thing just mellow in its own juices when it comes to the sous vide or the Dutch oven. Whether it's got the skin or whether it's not got the skin, it will get soft. Hank Shaw, big guy I follow. I would say I'd like to call him a mentor. He's given me a lot of stuff to think about and to work through. He said that a stone will even get soft if you braise it long enough. The leg will get soft here eventually. You just got to give it the 10 hours or you got to give it the 3 days in the sous vide, whatever direction you want to go with, but it will get soft and it'll be well worth it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like that you didn't even mention 8 hours there because it's not an 8 hour slow cooker.
No, just get to 10, go to 10, double digits. Yep.
Absolutely love that. Yeah. Cause it's always, I've noticed that the past couple of times we've done our slow cooker tacos, it's like, all right, it's been 8 hours. Let's check it. It's like, nope, not even close.
We gotta get her.
Yep. We gotta get her to 10. I love it, man. Well, dude, this has been awesome. I don't want to take up too much more of your Monday evenings because I know you got to get back to the kids and the family and everything. But man, give us a quick rundown of what you got coming up this spring and also where folks can go to find more about all the awesome work you're doing over at Hunterbore.
Yeah, busy time of the year. We're just wrapping up wrestling, which means spring break is around the corner. We've got a trip to go chase fish in the Gulf Shores. We're going to awesome. Do our hand at surf fishing. Did it once before down in Puerto Rico solo. A lot of research went into that, YouTube research. It's funny because like I feel like I knew enough deer hunting that I guess I wasn't surprised about new information. Like it was, I'm still approaching all of my hunting as a student. There's still something for me to glean, but there was something completely new about trying fishing from the beach. We're going to Puerto Rico. The wife wanted the drink. She wanted the umbrella. She wanted the beach. She wanted to lay out forever. And I'm like, that sounds awful. I'm going to get covered in sand. I'm going to be hot and I'm going to be bored. This does not sound fun. I'm going to find something to do. Surf fishing came up. Well, now I had my chance to do it. I showed the boys a couple photos of fish that I caught. Well, now we're going to Gulf Shores and they're like, get those rigs, Dad. We are going shore fishing. So
heck yeah.
Yeah, we got three rods ready to go. I had to put different color braided line. They wanted to pick their own color braided line. Through my research, I also found it doesn't matter the color. So I was like, good. We have a red, we have a blue, and we have a green. Everybody's got their own rod. A fourth rod is coming down for We're going to do a couple lures. I'm really emphasizing on these cast masters. I've heard really good work of these cast masters working in the surf. So we're going to give that a shot as well. But pompano is on the menu. Whiting is on the menu. Sheephead. Those are the three target species. But if we pull something out, we'll give it a go. We'll figure out how to cook it no matter what it is.
Heck yeah.
That's on the docket. I am joining a couple of the boys down in Oklahoma. We've got our hog camp down there, a couple former podcasters on Sportsman's Empire. We got John Hudspeth. We're going to go see him. We're going down with Nate Roosevelt, and we'll meet Andrew Muntz down there as well. And we're going to chase hogs. Nice. I tell you what an exhilarating hunt. Chasing hogs middle of the night with thermals. It is a blast. It is something so out of world that I can't explain. As a Michigander, I'm like, this is so fun. It has to be illegal. Well, here in Michigan, it is illegal, but down there it's not. So that's why we're going down there. So we'll be bringing back some wild boar. Awesome. Yeah. If you ever get a chance to do wild boar, do it. It's so much fun. And people tell you, oh, those stuff stink to high heaven. They are no good eating. It's because they're lying to you. They've never tried it, or they're trying to keep it for themselves. This is the best tasting pork that you can get on the planet. I would take wild over stored bought day in and day out. My wife enjoys it. She's got a pretty mild palate. Like, she can handle some gamey. So to say that my wife, who is pretty much through and through Dutch Michigander, she can handle wild boar and like it for all the nuances that it is. Like, it is extremely good stuff. So when people tell you it's bad, they're straight up lying to you.
How much meat are you bringing back from a trip like that typically?
We have brought back, first trip we brought back five. We brought back five big ass hogs.
No way.
Those went to a dinner that Nate did up north of here. Last year, I want to say I brought back three. I'm still sitting on a lot of pork. I'm questioning whether I take a sick day and just spend it next to the smoker, because I've got like four wild pork butts, pork shoulders, that need to go through the smoker and that need to get shredded up, bagged up, frozen up. I've got two big hinds that need to go to, I want to do the ham. I want to do the whole like Christmas ham thing with these. So they got to get cured. They got to get salted, and then they got to get smoked. But then, yeah, there's a load of sausage that I got to put together. I've been not doing bacon with the belly, but I've been doing its European unsmoked cousin, pancetta, not pancetta. I got yelled at for adding the H. Don't do that. I've been making pancetta, air dried pancetta. That actually was inspired by Dan Johnson as well. I started doing that mainly because a dish that he wanted me to do that he's gotten into was spaghetti carbonara. I did more of the traditional, but I added the wild boar flair. That is a great way to use that belly. They say it's too thin to do bacon. I can agree. You end up with shoestring bacon. It's very thin. It's good flavor, but it ain't gonna do much to you. Pancetta is gonna be a better way to use it. But hey, as we leave our friends here on your show, I will leave with why we were picking on Dan earlier. He actually called you out. Was it on your show or was it on his show?
Yep, it was last week. We were talking about, and I'm gonna be totally vulnerable here in that I was in a bit of a mood, all right, and I started cooking a burger the night prior. That was venison, and for some reason, the word veni popped into my mind instead of venison. And I got to just thinking about it. And I thought about it too much, to the point where I was like, you know what? I don't think I like referring to it as Venny. I think I like venison. And Dan mistook that as, well, you know what? We're going to get Nick on the horn because I know he says Venny and I know that we're going to. But then that somehow got misconstrued into what is venison? Is it elk? Is it moose? Is it all cervids? Is it only whitetail? And I was like, well, I'm pretty sure it's all cervid species. Is it not? You called me up and gave me the straight answer, which is.
I was just looking up my response here. So this is straight out of, where was it? This is straight up out of the Encyclopedia Britannica. The originally, venison was taken from Latin venari to hunt. All hunted at one point, way back when. All hunted meat was referred to as venison, not just even the cervids. We're talking about all sorts of wild beast at this point. All game was referred to as venny, as venison, venari. Hunting has been going on forever, a lot longer than our English translation. Now, so the word venison that we now use in our English language, I am referring to that as an umbrella. And in fact, I think the encyclopedia also agrees with me that all the cervids go underneath that. We're talking reindeer. We're talking caribou. We're talking red stag. We're talking muntjac. We're talking all those European varieties. We're talking whitetail, blacktail. We're talking, a whole number of cervids are going to fall under the venison category, in also the moose and the elk, which I would even say if you're referring to it as elk meat, that has got to probably be one of the more modern translations, because the real true translation of elk, I'm not even sure where that came from, because natively they're known as wapiti. So it should be the word elk is almost entirely out of English, derived out of English.
Yeah.
We're latecomers to it. So that would be like that modern translation. But to pull that one aside and to be like, listen, that gets its own distinction of elk meat. We can't do that. I mean, other than the fact that, like, let's take your beef, like people are now referring to Wagyu as its own thing. But at the same time, Wagyu is a kind of beef, a subspecies of cow at that point, or of beef. So anyway, and we refer to it all as beef at that point. Name your, I know what to call them, not species, but your breed of cow, it's all going to refer to that. Pork, there's a whole bunch of heritage breeds of pork, but it all falls under that distinction. So when Dan is saying that these get their own subsets of this is elk meat and it should be only known as elk meat, you're giving specialization to something that already has a distinction of being venison. Venny, as I refer to it, is shorthand for venison. Why am I comfortable with giving it the shorthand when you yourself won't go the shorthand, being that I think we're both here at, we value it the same. You're putting it up on a pedestal. My whole idea of being a podcaster is to talk about and elevate and raise up Venny.
Mm-hmm.
But Venny is such a commonplace in my diet. It's such a commonplace that I use that I feel okay giving it a shorthand because it's something that I'm very comfortable with. This is a nickname given to something that I'm close with.
Of course.
To keep to keep the regard of, I'm not going to shorthand this in speech and call it venison, portrays this means something to you, Pierce, that you're not willing to see it as commonplace. You're willing to make sure that this is something that is elevated. Given a piece of store-bought steak and set it next to one of your backstraps, without a doubt, not only did you fully write the word backstrap, but you also wrote venison. And if it was a buck you got, I guarantee you wrote the word buck and probably the points that it had on that piece of meat, on that packaging. Like, that's the amount of praise that is getting. And then if you had a choice, gun to your head, which one are you picking? You're taking the spelled out venison backstrap 9 times out of 10. No, I'm saying 10 times out of 10. You are going to take the one that you acquired versus the one you bought.
Absolutely. 100%. You are giving me far too much credit in the amount of thoughtfulness that I put into my argument. I think deep down, I was just being a little bit of an asshole, and I was just looking for something to complain about a little bit. And
oh, gotcha.
The way that it came in with you and your use of venison is, of Benny, excuse me, is because a guy like yourself who feeds his family and harvests so much venison on a yearly basis and cooks with it so religiously and talks about it weekly on a podcast, the amount of time that you would be wasting by saying venison all the way out instead of Venny, I mean, we're talking years off your life after a certain point, you know? Like, it's
how many
for you, it
inhales
makes sense.
And exhales that I would have. Although, if folks want to, I gotta come clean here. Is this a safe place, Pierce?
Yeah.
Or absolutely. A safe place? So
don't talk about the Lions anymore, but you can say other stuff. Yeah. Oh. I just know last time you talked about them back when they were good.
We did. We're hurting right now. We're hurting right now. We've been here before and we'll be here again.
Yep.
The Kool-Aid tastes so sweet at the beginning and it'll sour later. We don't have time for that. So I'm not the most organized person in the world. And I too fall prey to laziness. And as much as I try to portray that I may have a system and I may have a solution, I sometimes don't even listen to my own solutions and I fall into problems. I'm sitting right now with an 8-foot chest freezer that is more of a geological survey than it is like something to eat out of, in the fact that I have animal upon animal upon animal. I have a whole system. I have 2 upright freezers that we have used, but life got in the way, Pierce. Mm-hmm. And it was easy for me to then just put the animal on top of another animal. And now I have things that are buried and I can't get to them unless I unpack this chest freezer. For everybody who has a chest freezer, they're like, we get this. We understand this. I had a system, but here's the thing. The system fell apart and I need to remake the system. So that was my last week's episode, was talking specifically about that and how my shorthand at labeling, which when I do get people who get less venison, they do hold that, like when they process their venison, they have like, it is a big celebration. It's a big day. And they will then have the chance to write it out with a Sharpie. They'll write the date. They'll write the buck. They'll write the person who got it. They'll write the paragraph. It'll be like one of those new brands of snacks that come out and you always look at the back and it says our story. And you have a paragraph of how they made this Chex Mix, or are they on this new pretzel? This is our story. They put our story on the side of that packaging.
Mm-hmm.
And as you start doing not only your deer, you're doing your buddy's deer. Like, I just soon got a shorthand. I don't write backstrap on any rider. I write BS. And then now to the point where it's like, ooh, now I have boar and I have venison here. I shorthand Venny. So I got Venny BS all sitting in that chest freezer. Where in that chest freezer? I don't know, Pierce. It's somewhere between level 4 and level 5. There's there's fish in there now. There's boar. There's a freaking reindeer in there. I had the opportunity to have a farmed reindeer that needed to be processed. So I have that in there and I have venison. So I have like 4 species in here now mixed together. Remember that sick day that I was going to have? This is literally going to turn into a mental health day. I'm going to go in. It's going to be like going into a mental institution. There's no padded vest. There's no padded walls. It's me in this freezer and pulling everything out and finally making some sort of sense. So I'm not perfect, but that's going to be what I'm going to leave folks on, is that find Huntivore. If you love cooking and dealing with your wild game on another level, you're tired of the same old recipes, you're done with dry, tough turkey, tune into a couple of my episodes. Hopefully I can put you on the right path, because we're all in this together. Everybody's got their special attitude. Some guys chase turkeys and they're really good at being stealthy. Some guys can find the big bucks no matter where they are at. I'm just really good at dealing with after the shot. If you need somebody to call after you've shot it and it needs to get drug out and it needs to be field dressed and it needs to be turned into something delicious, that's when you give me a call.
I love it, dude. Folks, you heard it there first. Go check out the Huntivore podcast. Nick, dude, this has been an absolute pleasure. I can't thank you enough for taking time to come on the show and giving up some of your Monday night. On the note of confessions here too, I will say I grabbed 2 packages of ground out of my freezer this afternoon. One of them was neatly dated 11/10/25 for my buck. That's all it said. Just had a date on it. Did the other one didn't have a date. Nothing.
No
date.
I'm
no.
Sure it's fine.
I'm sure it's fine too. I know I did it. I don't know what it is though. So I don't know. That's my confession for today. But dude, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show, man. Stay in touch. Good luck this spring. Good luck down south, especially. And man, I look forward to the next time we have you back on the show.
Absolutely, Pierce. Keep your knives sharp, man.
Absolutely. See you, buddy.
That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at The Wisconsin Sportsman. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions you'd like me to explore on this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners, Lone Wolf Custom Gear, Onyx Hunt, Huntworth Gear, Good Chance Fly Fishing, and the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Please go support the brands that support this show. And if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other awesome outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.